All stations, all stations, all call signs. This is Wrecker Actual, over. Stand by for transmission. Prepare to copy. This is American Vindicta. Good evening. Welcome to episode 27 of American Vindicta. It's almost Christmas, and we've had a rough year. We've had a rough couple of years. And I look forward to 2022 and all the interesting things that are going to come with it. Rest assured, scandals and wars and rumors of wars and all those great pestilence that are out there are probably still going to be coming. But have no fear. God is with us. And we need to learn to be able to handle these situations a little bit better. And I don't think they're going to slow down. I think they're going to continue to progress forward very fast. And I think one of the better ways to learn how to deal with these situations, not just as a nation, but potentially militarily, is to go back into history. And so, you know, to accompany your Christmas presentation, I'd like to talk to you about some of the bloodiest wars of the American Revolutionary War. And the man who led almost every one of these, the most influential parts of these battles and skirmishes, was none other than George Washington. Now, on June 14th, 1775, Congress created the Continental Army. John Adams nominated the Virginia representative George Washington as the new army's commander-in-chief, and they had to quickly accompany this with a huge logistical train for food, paying the soldiers, recruitment, getting the proper uniforms, because George Washington wanted his military to look like a proper military while facing the British. It was kind of an eye for an eye kind of thing that he had against the other British. And, you know, the American colonials made up the majority still of the Continental Army. However, Washington took over all forces. And, you know, he had various generals who were subordinates under him who took over other wings of the military. But the main battles we're going to get into were led by Washington. Now, during the American Revolution, there were a recorded 230-plus skirmishes and battles that were fought in the colonies. And that's only what we know of. You know, history, unfortunately, is lacking in depth in certain areas, and we don't know every single skirmish and every single battle. So that's why I'm going to say over 230. And of those over 230 battles, George Washington was present for 17 engagements. 17 major engagements that were the turning points of the war. Now, you may say, Doug, 17 engagements out of 230 doesn't sound a lot. Well, you got to understand, the 13 colonies were drawn out from 1,000 miles plus, and there were fights everywhere. Not just engagements within the colonies, but engagements outside of the territories, and also naval engagements going on at the same time. So, I mean, back then with privateers, here's something funny. Just imagine the Second Amendment were ever revamped, right? In the late 1700s, privateers were given permission by the Congress, by the new Congress, that they could more or less arm their ships, their merchant vessels, and then harass British vessels. And one day we'll get into that. But let's just say that they were extremely successful of being professional pirates and harassing the British fleets and seizing many, many ships and a lot of their logistics And the French also helped us out with that, but oh, we Americans, we love our pirate history. So, what we're going to get into is the, right now I have a comprised list in order by date of the major engagements that General Washington was involved in. And I would like for you, I'm going to reference everything that I'm doing as usual. I would like for you to go to MountVernon.org. You can read in depth many of these battles, and we're going to read many of them. And I mean, there's no reason for me to sit here and ad lib everything and make up stuff. This is well drawn out. It's right there. It's at MountVernon.org. Please visit this website and educate yourself, but educate your children on true history and what it took to be an American back then. You got to understand, for the Revolutionary War fighter, they were fighting for this idea of freedom and being a independent nation, their own American empire, and they were fighting against the crown, the biggest, the baddest, the boldest empire in the world at that point in time. And to anyone else out there, it would look like we would have lost all day long from a professional military like the British compared to our ragtag band of, you know, hunters and colonial fighters who were fighting along with the British, alongside the British. We were frontiersmen expanding westward throughout the colonies and fighting with, you know, multiple skirmishes with Native American tribes. And we also just got done with a 7-year war with the French and Indian War. And that was mainly in the Ohio Valley up into the Quebec area. So, you know, Americans have had a long time of becoming these veteran war fighters. But one thing that was interesting was that during this point of time also, much of the British regulars that were coming over from England and landing were not veteran troops. Many of them had to be recruited or had to be pressed into service. And they were very young men, inexperienced. And Washington felt the same thing also when it came to his own recruitment. Even at one point, they didn't have any recruits for Washington to have, so they had to unload over 200 prisoners on him and say, here you go, Washington. And Washington was actually quoted as saying that it would be easier to bring the dead back to life than to make this group of soldiers work properly. You know, he had a lot of problems, but the British did too. But the thing the British had was they had seasoned veteran commanders, some of the brightest generals in the world at that point in time with the way that the British regular army was fighting. And they had seasoned non-commissioned officers who were leading these platoons and companies. And, you know, their discipline was par none. I mean, they were the best out there. They had some of the best artillery and long guns out there. They had some of the best powder, some of the best ball ammunition, some of the best muskets. Obviously, logistically, because an army travels on its stomach, as Napoleon says, they were very well funded. And they had everything that the Americans didn't have. But the thing that the Americans had, the thing our founding fathers had that they didn't, was they had a will to survive or to be controlled by a tyrant. Because once the revolution had started, there was no putting the genie back in the bottle. You had to go through with it or everyone was going to hang and the colonies would have been eventually destroyed. So America was put into a very tough choice. And George Washington, honestly, was probably the guy who started all this. It's amazing how God uses these people in history to bring us to where we're at now. So I would like to take us where we're at now and bring us back in time. Once again, come back in time with the trip with me. And we're going to visit some of the greatest sieges and battles that these United States within our coast from the entire East Coast where all the 13 colonies lied. We're going to experience some of these battles, and I'm going to share with you the casualties. I'm going to share with you the times and dates and a little bit of the information between these battles, but please go to MountVernon.org, read for it yourself. So starting with the Siege of Boston, April 19th, 1775. lasted through March 17th, 1776. That was an American victory. The next one, Battle of Long Island, August 27th, 1776, a British victory. Battle of Kips Bay, September 15th, 1776, another British victory. Battle of Harlan Heights, September 16th, 1776, an American victory. Battle of White Plains, October 28th, 1776, British victory. Battle of Fort Washington, November 16th, 1776. And we have the evacuation of Fort Lee, November 20th, 1776, which is a British victory. Battle of Trenton, December 26, 1776, which was an American victory. If you're an American and you don't know of the Battle of Trenton that happened in Trenton, New Jersey, shame on you. Battle of Second Trenton, January 2nd, 1777, American victory. Battle of Princeton, January 3rd, 1777, American victory. The Forage War, January to March 1777, ended in a draw. Battle of Brandywine, September 11th, 1777, British victory. Battle of the Clouds, September 16th, 1777, ended in a draw. Battle of Germantown, October 4th, 1777, British victory. Battle of White Marsh, December 6th to the 8th, 1777, draw. Battle of Monmouth, June 28th, 1778, draw. American victory in the Siege of Yorktown, September 4th to October 19th, 1781. Now, Washington ended up winning 6 out of 17 major battles and engagements, and he lost 7 out of 17 battles, to include 4 draws. Now, with these draws, it was either because of a tactical reason that the enemy fled, or they ended up fleeing before a true engagement really drawn itself out, and that's where the draw kind of came from. So the draws were really because there was not much of an engagement. Now, I want to share you a little fun fact, just so that you can understand what it was that these men went through. I want you to understand just how many died, just how many souls were lost. A total of 25,000 Americans died in the Revolutionary War from 1775 to 1783. Throughout the course of the war, an estimated 6,800 Americans were killed in combat, 6,100 wounded, and upwards of 20,000 were taken prisoner. Historians believe that at least an additional 17,000 deaths were the result of disease, including 8,000 to 12,000 who died as prisoners of war. We also know that during the winter encampment with George Washington's Continental Army, many died from starvation, some turned to cannibalism. Many were frozen to death. We don't really talk about this too much within the realms of war, but the weather has a lot to do with it. The weather stopped some of these major engagements we're going to go over after the break. And the weather also killed many. Now, these men did not have very warm clothes. The warmest thing you had back then was a wool overcoat, if you could afford one, or a wool blanket, if you could find one. And you know, their clothes were rattled riddled with disease. They all had, you know, at one point lice. They had all different types of infestations of rodents around the areas where they encamped at. The food was of very poor quality. They were having to constantly borrow food from farms or just go and seize food from farmers to include the cattle, to include vegetables. And before von Steuben, who was the man who really helped bring the American Continental Army to a professional army standard, before von Steuben came, there was a significant disease that was rampaging itself throughout the Continental Army. And you got to think, between dysentery and cholera and other types of outbreaks that were happening, between strep throat, fevers, severe diarrhea, which caused which would end up causing dehydration, which would end up, you know, causing even more problems for men. There was also, on one battle, up to 38 men died from heat exhaustion in just one battle. So the weather plays a lot when it comes to war, and it's one reason why I stress for people to be prepared physically and to have good clean water, have good bedding, have good medical treatments, and have a clean area to live at, because your recruitment after the war or after the skirmish or the battle may end up becoming more important than your battle itself was. Many of these men died from infection after these wounds, from being stabbed in the groin or stabbed in the stomach or in the chest by bayonets. There were also, you know, knife fighting with each other, because, you know, they weren't just standing toe-to-toe. They were, at some points, 100 to 50 meters away during these long engagements, and then eventually they marched into one another with bayonets fixed and were plunging up to 18 to 20 inches of steel right into each other. And that's how these men fought, for sometimes for hours, until there was no one left. So you have to understand the types of wounds, the lacerations, the puncture wounds, not just, you know, the broken bones from the cannonballs that were also de-limbing people, that were decapitating people, that were, you know, amputate the field grade amputations that were going on, people weren't surviving from either. Once you had your femoral artery cut and they put a tourniquet on you, and, you know, your leg is so ravaged, the only thing they could do was just take it off right there in the field. Most people just died from shock. So there is so much that goes into modern day medicine that we learned from previous battles hundreds of years ago. What happens the day we don't have these modern medicines? What happens when we don't have these life-saving machines that we have now, and you find yourself in a war that should have been 200 to 300 years ago? You know, don't think that can't happen tomorrow. The real difference between what these men went through in the Revolutionary War and what guys like me went through in Iraq really is just technology. At the end of the day, it was people fighting people, people killing each other, people being wounded in all different various ways, innocents being killed, and the thing that really separates us is technology. Honestly, so logistics and technology. But logistics and technology will go away with electricity. I'll say that again. Logistics and technology will go away when electricity goes away. I know I always harp on the whole EMP thing. Trust me, folks, you're gonna hear that it plays a lot into the future of this country. We're gonna go to a quick break and we'll be right back.
The time for political correctness is in the rearview mirror. The fact is, the American dollar is on the verge of collapse. It's been abused mightily by those in power. Massive debt, massive inflation have left Americans with few options. Most think they have no choice but to ride it out with their money in the bank. And sadly, they're going to awaken one day and all that money is going to be gone. Do you have an option? The answer is yes. Precious metals. But knowing to go into precious metals is not the same thing as knowing who to go into precious metals with. We have an answer for you. It's called Renaissance Precious Metals. It's owned and operated by the famed Steve Quayle, radio talk show host, world famous, and an expert in precious metals. Been doing the work for 34 years. So whether you're interested in gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, whatever your interest is, wherever you want to land in your escape pod, this is it. Renaissance Precious Metals can be reached at 406-586-4842. Call Steve Quayle at 406-586-4842. You can also visit them online at sqmetals.com. Ladies and gentlemen, don't wait. The collapse is underway. The time to act is now.
Well, welcome back. This is American Vindicta. We are talking about the Revolutionary Wars and some of the greatest battles that George Washington ever found himself in. Real quick, I would like to go over just who the Continental Army was. Just for your quick reference, in case you did not know, now you're going to. You will not have an excuse when I meet you somewhere randomly and I ask you a question about the Continental Army. The birth of the army. Congress initially opposed a standing army, but the first Continental Congress feared that a standing army could be used as an instrument of tyranny. This attitude changed after the Battle of Lexington and Concord. The second Continental Congress approved the formation of the army on June 14, 1775. The legislation placed the militia forces, then fighting outside of Boston, under federal control. These troops were formed the nucleus of the army. The date is still celebrated as the birthday of the U.S. Army, June 14, 1775. George Washington was named Commander-in-Chief on June 15, 1775. He assumed the command of the army in a field in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the following month. Washington served as the commanding general for the entire war and without a salary. The Continental Army reflected the diversity of the colonies. Coming from all 13 colonies, soldiers were native-born in America and also immigrants of almost every nationality, as well as free and enslaved African-Americans. Several women also disguised themselves as men in order to fight. The Army accepted volunteers as young as 16 years old. A 15-year-old could join with a parent's permission. And one artilleryman, Jeremiah Levering, who was reported to be 12 years old, was also seen at a battle. The size of the Army... over 230,000 soldiers served in the Continental Army during the entire Revolution, although no more than 48,000 at any one time. The largest number of troops gathered in a single place for battle was 13,000 American troops. And their commanding general at that battle was also George Washington. Training initially varied in quantity and quality from one regiment to another based on how much experience their leaders had. Congress hired Prussian Frederick Wilhelm von Steuben to direct the Army's training at Valley Forge. He published a training manual containing the regulations for order and discipline in 1779. Von Steuben organized a company of 100 soldiers that would demonstrate proper drill and battle tactics to newly recruited regiments. His efforts were instrumental in creating a professional army. Von Steuben really pulled together the army from being a ragtag band of colonial regulars, the militias, put together this group, taught them proper alignment within their ranks, taught them proper distance, taught them how to effectively all fire their muskets at one time and to reload quickly enough that the British would not have the opportunity to continue to fire throughout different volleys because the Americans were not doing very well at everyone all together shooting at once. And the whole portion of that was, when you have, 20 to 40 men who have a 50 caliber projectile and they're all going to fire at once, you have a greater accuracy by volume of rounds than you actually have the accuracy of one man at a time shooting at another man. So Let's just say, because the muskets, you know, they produce a lot of smoke, people didn't exactly look down the barrel and see exactly where they were aiming at. What they would do is they would lower the barrels towards the British. Everyone fire. 3, 2, 1. Bang. Everybody fires. Hopefully, 40 projectiles hit 40 people. You know, that was the way these men used to fight. And the ranks were taught not to break up so fast. They were taught proper withdrawal, proper coverage, proper bounding movements. When one group would push forward, the other one would maintain a course of fire and would cover that other unit. So, you know, there was a lot of things that came into this military training. And, you know, research von Steuben, he was probably just as important at one point as George Washington was. And I also believe if von Steuben was not recruited by Congress, we may have actually have lost the war. That's what I believe. The army, on paper, a soldier was supposed to be supplied with 1 pound of meat, 1 pound of bread, and 3 pints of dried vegetables each day, as well as a pint of milk and a quart of cider or spruce beer. This almost never happened. The army typically had to forage for food and often went hungry, diverting their scouts and other parts of their forces just to maintain a wagon train of animals, you know, your chickens, your goats, your dairy cattle, and also foraging for food and hunting for food, let alone keeping up the security for an encampment, both the internally and externally, and doing external patrols around the encampment, and running letters back and forth, and building new defenses, and sleeping occasionally, and also engaging the British. While all that was happening, they still had to go out and get their own food. It's quite an amazement when you really think about it. Soldiers were promised a pay of $29 per month, a small fortune for that time. Many of the colonies maintained their own currencies and exchange rates. The continental dollar was almost worthless, and Congress often lacked the funds to pay the soldiers, who remained true to the cause of liberty despite the hardships. Now, many, many did walk in and out of service. Many did leave. They did go home and actually resupply themselves from their own farms and brought back their own goods for themselves and for the men that they were serving with. But this did not happen regularly. This is very rare. More or less, if you were within the range of your homestead and you could go do that, if you were given permission, you would. But it was onesies and twosies here and there. It wasn't, you know, hundreds of men leaving at once. And that would almost be considered desertion at that point. Now, I want to get into the Siege of Boston, which was the first American victory that we had. And that was really the pivotal moment for Washington. The Siege of Boston, April 19th, 1775, lasted through March 17th, 1776. It was America's George Washington versus the British General William Howe, who ended up being the main antagonist throughout the entire Revolutionary War. America had about 11,000 soldiers, and the British had 9,400. The British eventually had to evacuate from Boston after endless amounts of bombardment. But the American casualties during this battle was about 469 killed or wounded and 30 captured. British casualties were 1,160 wounded or killed and captured 35. Listen to this genius. Washington was charged with forming these companies into an army and directing the siege of Boston. Knowing that he would be away for many months, Washington wrote to his wife, "I shall feel no pain from the toil or the danger of the campaign. My unhappiness will flow from the uneasiness I know you will feel being left alone. Washington worried that Virginia's governor, Lord Dunmore, would attack his plantation and even imprison his own wife. But still, he had no choice but to obey the kind of destiny that had given him this command and had to head for Boston. Upon arriving in Cambridge in early July, Washington proposed an attack on Boston. However, his officers were all against it. They argued that the British were still receiving supplies by sea. They urged Washington to wait until the waters around Boston were frozen. Washington sent an army instead to Quebec. He also ordered Henry Knox to march to Fort Ticonderoga and bring back the post's artillery. While the attack on Quebec failed, Knox did return to Cambridge in January 1776 with 59 much-needed cannons. Even with waters around Boston frozen, Washington's officers refused to attack the city. A frustrated Washington looked for another way to dislodge the British. On the evening of March 4, 1776, he directed his men to take the cannon from Fort Ticonderoga up to the Dorchester Heights south of the city. Washington also ordered his troops in Cambridge to fire upon the redcoats. The British blasted the American guns in Cambridge throughout the night, only to discover the many cannons pointed at them from the Dorchester Heights on the following morning. The British commander, General William Howe, remarked, "My God, these fellows have done more work in one night than I could make my army do in 3 months." Howe sent troops up Dorchester Heights to dislodge the guns, but a snowstorm prevented the assault. Fearing a brutal bombardment, he decided to leave Boston. On March 17, 1776, known afterward as Evacuation Day, 11,000 redcoats and hundreds of loyalists left the city by boat. Washington marched into Boston on March 18th, but there was little time for rejoicing. He rightly suspected that the British would head for New York City. As he prepared the next test of battle, one of his few comforts was the fact that his wife Martha had joined him in November. They would go together to New York, hoping that no harm would come to their own beloved Mount Vernon. Moving on, the Battle of Long Island. This resulted in a victory for the British. The battle happened August 27th, 1776. Following the successful siege of Boston, George Washington knew that it was only a matter of time before the British returned with more men, and he was certain that General Howe's objective would be the city of New York. Washington was correct, and in early July, the largest British fleet ever assembled to that point landed 32,000 men on Staten Island. While Washington strengthened his positions in Lower Manhattan, he also fortified Brooklyn Heights across the East River on Long Island. It was there on August 27, 1776, that Howe landed his troops and succeeded in flanking the American position through the unguarded Jamaica Pass. While soundly defeated, Washington was able to execute a nighttime evacuation of Long Island that saved close to 9,000 troops. During the Battle of Long Island, the strength of the Americans was at around 10,000 troops. Britain had a little over 20,000. Even though this did result in a British victory, the casualty rate wasn't nearly as high as one would think with the amount of fighting that happened. The American casualties ended up being 300 killed, 650 wounded, and 1,100 captured, while the British casualties were 63 killed and 314 wounded. Now, when you start to look at the way Howe was engaging Washington, he was very successful because General Howe knew tactics, and Washington did not have the same tactical prowess and experience that General Howe did. General Howe was very big on flanking maneuvers. while Washington was trying to push forward, he would bait him in and then send troops to either the left or left or right and would flank Washington's troops. Now, the thing that helped Washington is that while all these different attacks and engagements were happening, he was learning. He was monitoring the incidents. He was documenting it, and he would, you know, as he would go to retreat or tactfully fall backwards, what he would end up doing is also set up small ambushes. And the British were really caught off guard by this, and not only did it help with the retreat, but it stopped the British's engagement while chasing after the rear guard that Washington was leaving behind. Washington would, you know, leave these small ambushed troops here and there, and it helped to slow the advancement of the British, which really helped for the entire train of the troops to get out of the way and to get to safety. So that was quite ingenious at that point when you have, you know, not overwhelming troops that are not nearly as trained, that are not nearly as well-equipped as the British. And, you know, Washington knew that even though he didn't have the similar type of training for his troops and himself as the British did, nor did he have the ships or the gun or the powder or the money behind it, he knew that he would have to fight a defensive war in order to win this all-out war within the colonies. And his attacks ended up becoming very much bombardments or blitzkrieg-like surges into the enemy. But he was always fighting from, I guess you could say, an offensive-defensive position. He was always ready to go into a very defensive mode. And it ended up being a very good tactic because through hubris, the British would walk right in to the Continental Army and would walk right into their trap or would walk right into a very well fortified area. And it did not prove very well in many of these occasions for the British. And next on our list is the Battle of Kips Bay, September 15th, 1776. This led into a British victory. A brief summary is that during the Battle of Kips Bay, heavy advance fire from British ships into the East River caused an inexperienced American militia guarding the landing area to flee. Now, this made it possible for the British to land their troops and be unopposed by it. Skirmishes in the aftermath of the landing resulted in the British capture of some of those militia members. British maneuvers following the landing nearly cut off the escape route of some of the Continental Army and stationed further, I think, southeast on the island. The flight of American troops was so rapid that General George Washington, who was actually trying to rally his troops at that point, was left in the open, dangerously exposed to British lines. And didn't really have any cover or, you know, supporting elements around him, but he was just trying to rally his men to stand their ground and to attack. Now, the operation was a British victory, and this resulted in the withdrawal of the Continental Army to the Harlem Heights. Given the British control of New York City on the lower half of the island, Washington established strong positions on the Harlem Heights, which he proved determined to defend in a fierce skirmish between the two armies the following day. Now, General William Howe, unwilling to risk a costly frontal attack, did not attempt to advance further up the island for another 2 months. Now, during the Battle of Kips Bay, the American forces were commanded by Colonel William Douglas and consisted of about 900 soldiers. The British forces were commanded still by General William Howe and consisted of about 4,000 soldiers. American casualties were estimated to be 60 killed or wounded and 320 missing or captured. British casualties were approximately 12 killed or wounded. this was probably one of the, I guess you could say this was one of the pivotal moments within Washington's engagements, where he really had to take a step back and he had to watch how he was leaving troops throughout certain areas and the vulnerabilities of that. And, you know, we see from the British something that they had that the Continental Army didn't, and it's something that the Continental Army tried stopping, was for the British to be able to use their ships with their long guns, their heavy artillery cannons that were on these ships, floating these ships down these large rivers. It gave a very, very unique artillery advanced upper hand, I guess you could say, whenever they were allowed to be employed. Now, those engagements didn't happen too much throughout the battles, but they did happen. All right, next, the Battle of Harlem Heights, September 16th, 1776. This resulted in an American victory. Having abandoned New York, George Washington joined his troops along a new defensive line at Harlem Heights on September 16, 1776. Soon after he arrived, this position was tested by an advanced detachment of Howe's forces. Although the Continentals were initially pushed back, reinforcements and a flank attack ordered by Washington resulted in a British retreat and Washington's first battlefield victory of the American Revolution. Once again, we're hearing how Washington is learning through all these engagements, which is not, you know, the way you want to learn while your men are dying, but war is one of those very funny animals, and you know, you really just have to bend to its will at times if you don't have the necessary knowledge of how to fight it and survive it. Now, during this engagement, America lost 1,800 troops and the British, or excuse me, American had about 1,800 troops. The British had over 5,000. And the American casualties was 30 and 100 wounded. So 30 killed, 100 wounded. And the British casualties were 90 killed and 300 wounded. Battle of White Plains. The Battle of White Plains was on October 28th. 1776. This resulted in a British victory. With the British Army maneuvering to make his Harlem Heights position untenable, George Washington withdrew from the island of Manhattan and established a new encampment further north near White Plains, New York. On October 28, 1776, a flank attack by the British on this new position resulted in the collapse of Washington's line. Thankfully, he was able to orchestrate an orderly withdrawal that preserved the army. Unfortunately, Washington's retreat further exposed Fort Washington, which remained garrisoned on Manhattan. The Battle of Fort Washington, November 16, 1776. This resulted in a British victory. Following the defeat of George Washington's army at White Plains, New York, British General William Howe focused his army's attention on Fort Washington, the last post defended by the Continental Army on Manhattan. Although Washington hoped to abandon the fort, his officers convinced him that it needed to be held in order to keep the British ships from ascending the Hudson River. During a carefully orchestrated all-out attack on November 16, 1776, British and Hessian forces overwhelmed the fort's garrisons after vicious fighting. When he heard the attack began, Washington, who had stationed himself across the Hudson River in New Jersey, traveled across the river to enter the fort and personally inspect its defenses. Several officers accompanied Washington, including Generals Israel Putnam, Hugh Mercer, and Nathaniel Greene. They convinced Washington to leave the fort just 30 minutes before it was surrounded. The evacuation of Fort Lee, November 20th, 1776, resulted in a British victory. After the fall of Fort Washington, George Washington made plans for the evacuation of Fort Lee, which stood across the Hudson River in New Jersey, In a letter written to John Hancock on November 19, 1776, the general wrote that Fort Lee was always considered as only necessary in conjunction with Fort Washington, and that it would be abandoned as soon as provisions and others were removed. Unfortunately, a large British force succeeded in scaling the heights close to the fort on November 20, 1776. Faced with superior numbers, Washington called for the immediate evacuation of the fort, which resulted in the loss of dozens of cannons, 200 to 300 tents, and 1,000 barrels of flour. The Battle of Trenton, December 26, 1776, resulted in an American victory. After a string of defeats in New York, George Washington led his troops in a retreat through New Jersey and across the Delaware River into Pennsylvania. There, he faced dwindling supplies, desertion, and expiring enlistments. Realizing that his army desperately needed a victory, Washington planned for a nighttime crossing of the Delaware River in order to attack a Hessian garrison in the town of Trenton in New Jersey. Following a night of misery crossing the Delaware River in midst of a winter storm, Washington's troops were in position to attack Trenton just after 8 a.m. Caught completely by surprise, the Hessian garrison put up a brief fight before surrendering. Now, the Hessians were also recovering from hangovers from celebrating Christmas the night prior. And Washington knew this, and he gambled on it, and his gambles ended up being very successful. Now, Washington, whenever this original attack on Trenton had happened, there was supposed to be 3 to 4 different layers of attacks. But because of the weather and because of the Delaware River just being, you know, a field of icebergs, and back when I used to work in New Jersey, I have seen the Delaware River whenever it's frozen, and it looks like fields of icebergs at times. They just could not cross. It was too hazardous. So it ended up only being Washington and one other group, and they more or less came in north and south, caught them completely off guard. Now, the Battle of Second Trenton, January 2nd, 1777, which also resulted in another American victory. Washington's troops secured a tremendous victory in their surprise attack on the Hessian garrison at Trenton, New Jersey, but the general was not content. He determined to recross the Delaware River in order to recruit additional militiamen and establish a secure winter encampment in northern New Jersey. While Washington made his plans, General William Howe tasked Lord Charles Cornwallis with bringing the area back under British control. The town of Trenton, New Jersey, would once again become a battleground as Cornwallis made contact with Washington's troops. Cornwallis skirmished with Washington's troops on the outskirts of town before assaulting Washington's main force, which was entrenched along the Assunpink Creek, with only one bridge usable to attack Washington's position. The Continental Army turned back 3 different British assaults across this bridge. Despite tremendous casualties, Cornwallis was determined to renew the attack the following morning. Unbeknownst to him, Washington decided to attack a smaller British force in Princeton. Washington left behind a small detachment of infantry and several cannons. These troops fired occasionally at the British positions and kept fires burning along Washington's old line to convince Cornwallis that his main force was still there. The Battle of Princeton, January 3rd, 1777, resulted in an American victory. Following fierce fighting between Lord Charles Cornwallis and Continental troops at the Battle of Second Trenton, George Washington skillfully disengaged along his position at Assunpink Creek during the evening of January 2nd, 1777, in order to attack the British post at Princeton, New Jersey, the following morning. As dawn broke on January 3, 1777, Washington's forces was spotted by British troops in Princeton under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Charles Mahood. Although American troops faltered after fierce fighting with British light infantry, reinforcements and the appearance of George Washington turned the tide. Washington personally led the newly arrived troops into battle, exposing himself to the enemy's fire. Now we're going to take a quick break and we will be right back.
Klaus Schwab from the World Economic Forum has said, "You will own nothing and you will love it." And that's represented by what's going on across the planet today, where the economy of the world is in free fall, and nowhere is it more in evidence than with our own President Biden deliberately trying to sabotage what we have, access to food, other resources. So Americans are in a unique position. Really, for the first time in our history, we're going to have to provide for ourselves or subject ourselves to the whim of the government. Do you really trust a government to feed you that left 1,000 Americans behind enemy lines in Afghanistan? I don't think so. So where do you go? When you ask the question, who's the best prepper out there today? There's only one answer. Ready-Made Resources and Robert Griswold. I call him King Prepper, and that's how a lot of people think of him. You have everything there you'd want, from night vision to storable food, how to prepare cooking in emergency situations, books and videos on how to prepare alternative energy, communication, first aid that you wouldn't think of, natural antibiotics, you name it, Bob has it. Now, here's the good thing about Bob Griswold that no one else does but him. You don't have to buy anything to talk to him. If you're not sure where to start with your preparation, no obligation phone call directly to Bob. You can talk to him for free. Most people will charge you an arm and a leg for a half-hour conversation. That's not Bob Griswold. He cares about helping America get prepared. Go to readymaderesources.com or you can call the number directly at 800-627-3809. Again, that contact information, readymaderesources.com for the best prepping outfit in the country, or call Bob Griswold directly, 800-627-3809.
And we're back. This is American Vindicta. We don't have too much time left, so I'm going to read to you the quick summary of George Washington's victory in Yorktown. Now, the siege of Yorktown happened between September 14th and October 19th of 1781. Between 1778 and 1781, after the British withdrawal from Philadelphia, George Washington placed his army outside of New York and waited for an opportunity to attack the forces of General Sir Henry Clinton, while the British waged a largely successful campaign across the south of the lower colonies. Late in the summer of 1781, the British, specifically Lord Cornwallis, finally made the mistake that Washington had been waiting for. Cornwallis entrenched his army around Yorktown, Virginia, where he waited for either reinforcement from Clinton or for evacuation to New York to open up. Now, Washington quickly moved south with his French allies that he had now made and coordinated with the Marquis de Lafayette to keep Cornwallis in place in Yorktown. At the same time, French naval forces maintained control over access to Chesapeake Bay, which prevented naval assistance and reinforcements from reaching Yorktown. Washington himself fired the first American cannon of the siege. The capture of key portions of the British entrenchments and the opening of a second Allied siege line signaled the end for Cornwallis, who formally surrendered on October 19th, 1781. This was the last siege and the last battle that Washington had to fight. And you should really read really read up on it. It is truly spectacular when you see just what these men went through. And, you know, I mean, from the point of having to carry, you know, hundreds of pounds of ammunition, just within boxes on, you know, horse and buggy at times, to whenever the horse and buggy was stuck in the mire and you had to carry it, or you yourself had to push the cannons 50 to 100 miles just to get to certain locations, or just to escape with your cannons. It is just truly awe-inspiring what these men did. And just a real quick thing I thought you might like to know. Under Washington's command, 1,428 men died in action. They were killed in action. 2,435 were missing in action or captured by the British. 3,191 were wounded. The battle for the initial beginnings of America was very, very bloody. Politically, it was probably the darkest time we've ever been in. And when we talk about what it means to be an American, we must look back into the men who created America, their reasons for it, their problems that they had with their, I guess you could say, overlords from the crown, and why they chose to fight. If it ever comes time in this country, should we choose to fight? Should we need to fight? Should we be under the rule of a tyrannical government? Look back in history and see what these men went through. It is inspiring to see what they thought it meant to be an American. This is this week's last episode, episode 27, on what it means to be an American. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Doug Thornton. This is American Vindicta. Out. All stations, all call signs. Prepare for transmission. This is Wrecker Actual. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. End of transmission.